This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. What is school choice? Your answer depends not only on your political perspective, but also on what is happening in your town and school district. Across Vermont, there are almost as many possibilities as there are supervisory unions. There are towns where there isn't a high school or middle school and families get to choose where to send their children. There are towns where there's a designated school that students go to. There are towns where there is no school choice, and there are others where there's some, but it's limited. So when people have conversations or debates about school choice in Vermont, they're not always coming from the same starting place. Today on the show, we wanted to get a primer of sorts on what school choice is in Vermont, how Act 46 affects choice, and how Vermont fits into the national debate. If you want to share your experience or your questions, call 1-800-639-2211. That's 1-800-639-2211, or post a note on the Vermont Edition show page at vpr.net. We are joined today by Dan French, coordinator of the School Leadership Graduate Program at St. Michael's College. He's also been a superintendent and a principal in Vermont schools, so he has seen this issue play out in a lot of different ways. Dan, welcome to Vermont Edition.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Let's talk first about names and words and what they mean. Always good for an education show. Insofar as the phrase school choice has a definition that is singular, what is it? Just the concept that families should get to choose where their children go to school beyond doing that by choosing where to live, like where to rent an apartment or buy a house. Is school choice as a concept just this idea that you should be able to choose what school your kids go to?
Yeah, as you said, it's fairly complex. But I begin to explain it by saying, firstly, the state in Vermont has a responsibility for education. And the state has delegated that responsibility, which comes from the Vermont Constitution, to local school districts, which the state essentially controls the configuration of school districts. Under the law, school districts have two options to achieve the state's responsibility. One is to operate a school. The other option is to not operate a school and provide tuition. And in Vermont, we have sort of on a continuum, we have districts that operate schools, we have districts that don't operate any schools, and then we have districts in between. Common configuration might be operating a K-6 school and then providing tuition for students in grades 7 through 12, or operating a K-8 school and providing tuition through 9 through 12. So those are the basic responsibilities, and a school district on behalf of the state is required to educate its students. So from the parents' perspective, when they encounter this issue of choice, really what they're encountering is a decision on the part of the local district to operate a school or not to operate a school.
And the reason that we have this sort of patchwork quilt of options is just because the way Vermont is configured and having this concept of local control?
Yeah, I think to a certain extent. But as you know, Vermont's geography is fairly rural. So I think what we see is, school choice or enrollment options in the state, it's really a function of the rural nature of our state. Certainly in very rural areas, it didn't make any sense, I would assume, for them to build a school or operate a school. So the ability to tuition students out of the district was a real good solution. I think the other issue that's emerged over time, about 1900 or so, the issue of high schools. You know, in many cases, high schools were private academies, and many of those high schools or private academies made the transition to become public high schools in their communities. But there are several, about four in Vermont, that remain independent academies. I think it is a function more of history than anything else in the geography.
Maybe it's easiest to start with the towns that don't have a school, whether that is a K through 6 school or they don't have a middle school and a high school. And we can talk a little bit about what the options are in those towns. And those are the towns that are called tuitioning towns.
That's a term of art used locally. But essentially, once again, if you don't operate a school, you still have a school district and you have a school board, and that district and that school board is responsible for educating the students. And under the law, if they don't operate a school, then they must provide tuition for students to attend some other school. So that's when I was a superintendent, for example, I was superintendent of Wynn Hall School District, which is what we call a non-operating school district. If you were a resident pupil of Wynn Hall, you could choose to go anywhere, basically, and the district would pay a certain amount for you to be educated in some other district.
Well, that gets us to the fact that even within these tuitioning towns where there isn't a school, there are a couple of options that the townspeople and the school boards can then take. And one of them is, as you've said, to say to students in that district, you may choose or your family can choose to send you to whatever school in Vermont that's, you know, accredited and allowed. And those tuition dollars will go with you. But that's not the only option. Towns can also designate schools.
Yeah, there's, you know, I gave a sort of a rough overview. It gets fairly complex from there on out.
Oh, good.
Yeah. So, I mean, first we have two criteria. It's not any school. The school, to be eligible to receive public tuition dollars, must be have an approved curriculum and must be a non-sectarian school. Short of that, I mean, it's pretty open where people can go. The local district does not pay parents. It pays the school directly. That was a key consideration that was developed. And the amount that gets paid is also an area that there is some flexibility on that. The default amount is decided in the law to be what we call a union tuition rate average. Union districts are these larger school districts in Vermont that have a certain economy of scale. So the default is that's the amount the district would pay. But there is a mechanism in the law that allows local voters to pay a higher amount if they so choose. And that's something that's reserved to the voters.
Right. And then but again, to this idea of where can students go to school, in some cases they can go to any of those schools, but sometimes there are designated schools, right?
Oh, the issue of designation, right. So, yeah, designation's a little different. In my old supervisor union, we had a few districts that had special dispensation to designate New York schools, New York high schools. So under designation, essentially you don't have school choice. For all intents and purposes, the designated school becomes your official school, and that's where your students have to go. But there's a mechanism in the law, as there are in many cases in Vermont, a way around that, where there's an option with parents if they're concerned that the designated school doesn't provide what their student needs. They may approach the school board and ask to be allowed to send their students some other place. So designation essentially is not school choice.
But so you couldn't have like three designated schools? So if you don't have a school in your town, could you say students may go to any of these three designated schools but not any school?
Yeah. So prior to Act 46, designation was restricted to only one school. So a district, if it was going to designate, would only designate one school. And actually going back a little bit in history, not too long ago, designation really was only available for independent schools. So a public school district could designate an independent high school. And at some point, the law was modified to include public high schools as well.
And this would apply to schools like the Sharon Academy or Burr and Burton or St. Johnsbury Academy,
yeah.
These sort of independent public-private schools?
Yeah. Historically, like I said, now designation is available for public schools. I mean, the trick with designation, as much as you might want to designate a school, the school has to agree to the designation. So it's not something that you can just force on people. Act 46 includes a mechanism, however, that allows a newly merged district to designate more than one school, up to three. So that's where probably you're getting the three idea.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the lawmakers envisioned that in areas where designation was an issue, they wanted to anticipate merging districts to have the opportunity to designate more than one if they so chose to do so.
We're talking today about school choice. As you can see, it gets fairly complicated fairly quickly, but we're trying to keep it as understandable as possible because so many conversations in Vermont around education, around Act 46, and national conversations about school choice are happening right now, and we want to make sure we're all on the same page about what we're talking about when we think of school choice. So, listeners, if you have a question, or if you want to share your own experience, your district's experience, you can call 800-639-2211. That's 800-639-2211. You can also post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page. We're talking with Dan French, who's coordinator of the School Leadership Graduate Program at St. Michael's College and has a lot of experience in Vermont schools as well. And Dan, we've talked about the communities that send students or where there is school choice, and you mentioned that it's kind of like marriage. The other school has to agree to be a designated school. For communities where there is choice and students can go anywhere, do the schools where those students wind up going have a say in how many students outside of their district they will take?
Yes, they do. And that's sort of the downside, I would say, of not operating your own school is that you lose some control over those kinds of decisions. And the default position in the law in Vermont is that school boards that operate schools – really are only responsible for educating the resident pupils of their community. So students coming in from another community, a choice town, if you will, the school district has some control over whether or not to admit those students. There's no requirement that they do so. Generally speaking, those districts have policies that describe the process by which they would deny a student admission. Policies, for instance, that would prohibit them from discriminating against a student based on disability or what have you. But, you know, bottom line is the receiving district, if you will, if they're an operating district, has quite a bit of control over denying admission to students.
Have you ever seen that become a problem?
Absolutely.
Can you give me an example?
An example would be students coming in might precipitate a receiving district having to hire new staff or additional staff, and the district saying, and a central feature of these policies usually is the consideration of capacity. You know, so if we in our district only have room for two students, coming from someplace else, that's what we're going to take, and beyond that, we're not going to hire staff. So it's largely a financial consideration for districts. If they have to invest in additional resources to receive those students, they're going to be thoughtful about accepting them. I mean, in the last 10 years or so, in this era of declining enrollment, many receiving districts have been very interested in taking on tuition students because that's revenue basically for them that helps lower the tax rate. So it isn't as common, but it has been a consideration. It's essentially around resources. Do they have space and so forth?
VPR's Howard Weiss-Tisman has been doing a series all week on VPR this week about school choice, focusing really on the issue of independent schools. And one of the questions that comes up is, should those independent schools be required to take, since they are taking tax dollars and public school students, should they be required to accept special education students and all types of students and maybe not have quite as strict admissions policies for those students, given that they're taking taxpayer dollars? How do you explain how that works and is legal?
Yeah, it's a great it's a great debate right now, and one I'm sure we'll be spending more time on. But, as I mentioned, you can start to understand the historical evolution of how we ended up where we are in Vermont. And historically, due to the geography and the rural nature of our state, school choice or non-operating schools became a reasonable solution for rural districts in particular. We start talking today about, particularly in the last 20 years or so, where there's been a significant increase in the regulatory environment around public education, particularly from the federal government. And so now there's increased pressure on the state and on local entities to ensure that tax dollars are being used in a manner consistent with federal law and state law. So we run into this issue of, if a school district doesn't operate a school and, the state ultimately is responsible for education of students, they've delegated that responsibility to the local district. The local district doesn't operate a school, doesn't have an apparatus available or a system available to ensure students are meeting those criteria. It does put pressure on the situation to say, well, to what extent should independent schools be regulated if those tax dollars are being passed on to them? So I think, this is a debate we saw, I think, starting this summer more so with the State Board of Education debating the revision to their rules over independent schools. And it's one probably is going to be a significant policy debate going forward because I think if you go back and look at look at the Vermont Constitution and the responsibility the state has to ensure the education of all students, under that sort of logic model, we're going to have to reevaluate, I think, to what extent anyone who takes those dollars is held accountable for meeting those requirements.
As you might imagine, we've gotten some comments about that issue of independent schools getting Vermont public school dollars. Diane in Jericho says, in the post-Brigham and Act 60 landscape in Vermont, we have a statewide funding system of property tax for our students. Some towns continue to have what amounts to a tuition voucher that can be used worldwide to selective and specialized academies. I'm speaking of the Vermont public private academies, she says. Generally accessed by families of economic means to support expensive tuition, I do not understand why this inequity is allowed to continue when it's paid for by all of our taxes. In Chittenden County, it is clear either you pay for private tuition on top of your property taxes or you attend a public school. When did we decide as a state that it was acceptable to use all of our tax dollars to support tuition vouchers for a select few in this manner? How is this fair to all students and all taxpayers? And I'll read a couple of others as well while we're talking about this. George in Brattleboro says, suppose for a moment this discussion was happening 40 or 50 years ago in, say, Alabama. Brown versus the Board of Education resulted in many private schools springing up. Public money paid part of the cost, but parents had to come up with additional funds to pay the tuition, and many parents did so, many white parents. Black parents couldn't afford it. The result was continued segregation, which was what the white parents wanted. Fast forward to today in Vermont, for the most part, the skin color of all involved is white, but much of the rest seems the same. The private schools accepting public money are allowed to discriminate against people with physical disabilities, learning disabilities, or behavioral problems, or people who can't pay the tuition differential. The result is a system segregating, quote, normal students or, quote, good students or rich students from the rest of the student population. And let's go to Dan calling in from South Burlington. Hi, Dan. Go right ahead.
Yeah, some of those points, I think we should really recognize what tuitioning dollars is. It's essentially a $15,000 gift, tax-free. It's money. It's public money. That would be the equivalent of like, you know, $20,000 in real income to a family after tax. And, you know, I think you're cast outline how this, it's not as if many of these places don't have a public high school. It's not like 100 years ago when there were just the big regional academies. There are public high schools throughout the state. And as a taxpayer, it just really galls me. I get that people might want the choice, but if you want the choice, pay for it with your own money. Don't ask me as a taxpayer to help pay for it. That's the challenge. And I don't know how we unwind it, but one of the first things we could do is stop the flow of tax dollars to out-of-state academies and maybe just start to say, you don't get 100% of the $15,000 if you want to go to a private school. You get 75% of that money or whatever, just to... We can't afford it anymore, and it's not equitable.
Dan, thanks for your comments. I appreciate that. Dan French, can you talk a little bit about this? Because, you know, I think, again, we're getting to this question of who is actually getting to send their students to these academies, to these private schools? Is it just the towns that don't have a high school, that are tuitioning towns, that students are allowed to go anywhere, who are allowed to use those dollars at these academies?
Yes. I mean, when you start talking about public tuition dollars being appropriated and being sent to these schools, they're really only coming from districts that don't operate comparable schools.
Do you know how many students that is?
I do not. But the other issue I would just point out, as you were saying, I mean, it's hard in the state when so many people have different experiences with this issue. And I think, you know, there's many different types of independent schools in Vermont. So I'm – even with someone with some experiences myself with this, I'm hesitant to sort of characterize them all being the same way. I know the four large independent academies, which really stand out in my mind as a subgroup, really do accommodate all students and operate very efficiently. And in those communities, I don't see them ever building a high school as a way to resolve this issue. But on the other hand, we've seen a proliferation of small, I would say, boutique independent schools, much smaller schools that don't operate on the same scale and don't necessarily accommodate all students. And that's a real policy concern, I think, and that's one we're going to have to debate more as a state.
Although some of these, what you suggest might be called boutique academies, cater to or serve a niche population of students who do
right.
have behavioral issues or
That's
developmental
true.
Issues. So it's not
yeah. –
we're not only talking about schools that serve a population of elite students. It may be schools that have a different kind of
right.
perspective, right?
So yeah, that's correct. So I mean it's the full gamut. And I think in the case of the large independent academies, when you start talking about costs, the caller was mentioning the concern about cost. In many cases, that amount that gets sent to them is lower than the tuition paid to the local public high school. And in many cases, there isn't a local public high school, but the nearest public high schools are sometimes more expensive. So I think you really have to understand the entire landscape. But it is going to require, I think, is what we're hearing, is it's going to really require thoughtful policy deliberation on this issue. Act 46, I think, is certainly shedding some light on it, as is the increase in the regulatory environment in which we're operating.
We're talking about school choice today, and coming up, we're going to look a little bit more at how Act 46 actually has an effect on school choice, in what ways and how is it written, and what might actually happen on the ground. Listeners, if you have a question or you want to share what your district does, you can post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. 1-1. I'm Jane Lindholm, and this is Vermont Edition. Today, we're learning more about all the various different ways Vermont schools and communities organize school choice. Our guest, Dan French, has been a superintendent and a principal, and he's now coordinator of the School Leadership Graduate Program at St. Michael's College. If you want to share how it works in your district or ask a question, post a note on the Vermont Edition Facebook page or call 1-800-639-2211. Again, that number is 800-639-2211. And let's get a perspective on the ground right now. Mike Talbot is a school board member in Grand Isle, and he's on the line to offer the perspective of his town, which has long dealt with this issue of school choice and is also grappling with Act 46 merger plans. Mike, it's nice to have you on the program.
Nice to be with you.
So currently, Grand Isle Supervisory Union is comprised of Alberg, South Hero, North Hero, Grand Isle, and Isle Lamotte. Can you just tell us, first of all, how many students are tuitioned and mainly where are they going? Because you don't have a high school, for example, in Grand Isle.
That is correct. Grand Isle County does not have a high school, so all of our high school students are tuitioned for all five towns. And that's approximately 300 high school students across the county. And we basically send our students to about 15 different school districts, ranging from Northeast Clinton in New York, where a lot of the Albert kids go, to, you know, the majority would definitely go to Chittenden County Schools, South Burlington, Colchester, Essex.
And then some up to St. Albans?
Yes, BFA St. Albans does take in a fair amount of Alberg students as well, the ones that do not go to Northeast Clinton or Missisquoi.
But like we've been talking about with Dan French, students are allowed to go wherever they choose. So in some cases, do you have students who are going farther afield or going to private schools?
We have a few. We have one student out of the 300 that goes to an out-of-state private institution. I believe it's Berkshire Academy. We have two students at St. Johnsbury Academy, two at Linden Institute, and then we have 10 that go to the Vermont Common School in South Burlington, but they're not boarders. They commute back and forth daily like all the other high school students.
So
it is a relatively small percentage going to the private high schools.
And what about the issue of transportation? How do students get to these schools?
The larger districts, Colchester, Essex, and South Burlington, all send buses through the islands to pick up and bring home our high school students. And some of the schools even offer an activities bus that leaves the prospective schools at, say, 6 p.m., like if they have, you know, a sports activity or any other club activity after school, they can catch the later bus.
Why not just have a high school on the islands? I mean, you've got, as you said, about 300 students who are tuitioned out. Why not build a high school?
Well, I've only lived in the islands for 15 years. So I'm sure, you know, someone that has been there much longer could offer more insight into that. I know there have been talks at times about building a high school. There was, I think I went to an open forum maybe 12 years ago when it was discussed. And, you know, I think the cost implications to build a new school from scratch and have it fulfill the needs of the entire county would be somewhat difficult. You know, Grand Isle County is small geographically, but it's very long, you know, from the Canadian border in Alberg to the sandbar. You're looking at, you know, over a 30-mile distance there. So it's pretty unique geographically compared to the rest of Vermont, and I think that plays a part as well. And the other thing I heard too is that, you know, most of the parents that had already sent their children to a high school at that point we're very happy with the outcome of the school choice.
Mike, under Act 46, which people will remember is the school district merger bill, mm-hmm. Your towns did vote, and your new district under Act 46 includes Grand Isle, North Hero, and Isle Lamont. And one of the topics that comes up about Act 46 is how it affects school choice. How is this new merger plan and the decisions by the voter going to affect school choice in your new district?
So Isle Lamont and North Hero have been tuitioning their 7th and 8th graders for a number of years up until now. And I was actually on the Act 46 committee, which was a committee of 18 people that had representatives from all five towns. And currently South Hero, Grand Isle, and Alberg are pre-K through 8 school districts. Isle Lamont, North Hero, like I said, are pre-K through 6. Because of the wording of Act 46 and keeping everything fair and consistent, we had to agree on one structure, either pre-K through 6 or pre-K through 8. North Hero and Isle Lamont are extremely happy with the pre-K through 6 model. We weighed costs of both plans. And Grand Isle put it on a ballot in November, and it passed to go to a pre-K through 6. South Hero voted it down. Alberg did not vote at all. So basically, those three towns, Grand Isle, Isle Lamont, and North Hero, will be tuitioning their 7th and 8th graders. Grand Isle will start tuitioning in 2019.
So essentially, it expanded school choice in Grand Isle with this new merger, and that's based on what the voters decided.
Exactly.
Mike Talbot is a Grand Isle School Board member. I really appreciate you telling us a little bit about what's happening in your community and your new supervisory union as it goes into effect in 2019. Mike, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
And listeners, we are talking about school choice today. More of your thoughts, your experiences, you can share them with us on the Vermont Edition page at vpr.net, or you can call 1-800-639-2211. Let's go to Glenn, who's calling in from Ludlow. Hi, Glenn. Go right ahead.
Okay. I'd like your speaker to perhaps address, the machinations of Act 46 and why here in Ludlow we can't seem to, come up with a solution. Act 60, Act 68, and now Act 46 is, really destroyed what is a community through, looking at school and education financing. And here in Ludlow, we've got, a town of about 2,000. We've had committees coming out the yin-yang to look at and study and try to figure out what's going to happen. And my latest comment online was that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Nothing has changed. And we're facing the prospect where, we're going to try to operate a high school, which is also middle school, and continue to operate an elementary school. And who knows really what's going to happen.
Yeah, Glenn, thanks for your call. I appreciate that. Our guest today is Dan French, coordinator of the School Leadership Graduate Program at St. Michael's College and a longtime Vermont educator and administrator. So, Dan, what do you think about what Glenn's talking about?
Yeah, I mean, it's indicative of the pressures communities are under with Act 46. But this issue, as the caller from Grand Isle said, that under Act 46, when districts merge, they have to arrive at the same enrollment pattern. So, if two K-6 districts, meaning that they were operating schools K-6 and had choice 7 through 12, come together under Act 46, that's a very easy process. On the other hand, if you had a district that was a K-6 and had choice 7 through 12, trying to merge with a district that was K-8 and had choice 9 through 12, something needs to change in order for those districts to merge because there can only be one enrollment pattern in a district. So for those, in the areas where there's lots of small school districts with a variety of enrollment patterns, this puts a lot of pressure on the communities to try to figure out a solution.
We got a note from Meredith who says, I live in Wells, Vermont. My children can go to either Pulteney High School or Granville, New York High School. I have a son who went to Fairhaven High School for a few weeks until we were told he cannot go to public school there without an additional very expensive fee because Granville is our designated school. Other kids who live in Pulteney went to Fairhaven High School for free under school choice. It doesn't seem right to me. Can you explain what Meredith's talking about?
Yeah, I'm familiar with that situation. Wells, along with Paulette and Rupert, were two of my school districts, are the three school districts under the law that are allowed to designate New York high schools. So the way the designation statute works is that when it comes time to determine a tuition rate, it's the lesser of the designated school's tuition rate or the union school district average. Well, New York State subsidizes their schools to a greater extent than Vermont, so their tuition rates in New York are much lower. So if you're in a situation, as this person is in Wells, Granville's tuition rate, the designated school's tuition rate, is about $9,000 a year. And if you wanted to go to Fairhaven, Vermont Public School, all the district would give you is the $9,000 because that's the designated tuition rate. So the parent would be responsible for the difference out of their own pocket, which is probably $6,000-$7,000.
You know, another thing that Meredith's bringing up, though, is even is this question of inequity or fairness that people a question, you know, that some communities have school choice, which allows them to send their children to whatever school they deem is the most appropriate for their child or the best for their family dynamic, or maybe it's the school with the best special needs work, or maybe it's the school with the best sports. And then other communities that either have a designated school or have a school don't have that same choice. And here we're getting into this national discussion about school choice. Do you see that conversation about inequity and even as it applies to socioeconomic inequities, even within school choice, you know, how it's all playing out here as well as on the national scale?
Well, it will. You point to a very important issue. I think, you know, we can talk about the historic complexity of Vermont's choice landscape, but looming over us now apparently is going to be a more pointed conversation at national policy level about choice. And I don't see them being necessarily the same issue. I think on the national level, what's being contemplated is really a discussion about school choice as a means to improve schools, meaning that in many urban districts, for instance, where, you know, there's really pretty intense poverty and poor outcomes in the public school, that choice is seen as a way to liberate people from those institutions and systems. But that's not necessarily our issue in Vermont. But, you know, back to the Wells issue, you know, what's happened in that community is the community as a whole has made that decision to designate New York. So the community as a whole has the local authority to decide that issue. And certainly individuals in the community could disagree with that, but the resolution is still available locally. You know, that community and Wells is actually moving forward with a merger proposal under Act 46 with their neighbors to give up the designation. So under that situation, they'd have more flexibility and there would be greater equity.
That question of equity within school choice districts, though, is another one that comes up because, you know, we were just talking about Grand Isle and where students go. And in some cases, there's public transportation to those schools. In other schools, you're not going to get public transportation. So it's reliant on parents or the students to have the ability to travel to these schools. And don't we then get into as well, even within a school choice district, that there could be socioeconomic disparities in who gets to choose what school their students go to?
Yeah. I mean, it's I think the logic behind school choice is that everyone can choose, therefore it's equitable. But I think it's clearly, in my experience, not everyone has the same choice. And the issue of transportation comes up frequently. Transportation is an issue that's left to the local school district to decide. So South Burlington could decide to send a bus up to Grand Isle. Grand Isle as a school district could decide to provide transportation to South Burlington if it so decided to do that. So we've left issues like that to local authorities. And these things will also have to be reconciled, particularly under Act 46, as districts merge, because in many cases where districts have different enrollment patterns, they also have different approaches to things like transportation. So when you create one district, the local school board, generally speaking, will only have one approach to transportation, and they'll be that'll definitely be creating some interesting political conversations at the local level.
Well, there's certainly more to talk about. I really appreciate you coming on and trying to give us a primer here on how school choice works in Vermont so that these future conversations can perhaps all start from the same place. Dan French is coordinator of the School Leadership Graduate Program at St. Michael's College and a former superintendent and principal in Vermont schools. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Coming up, the need to diversify in agricultural practices and the story of Nadia Boulanger, who was such a well-regarded music teacher that, here we go again, school choice, students traveled from around the world to be taught by her. This is Vermont Edition. This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. The Vermont Folklife Center in Middlebury has created a series called Growing Food, Growing Farmers. It is focused on the Rutland County agricultural community. Each month, we share a few of the voices from that series on Vermont Edition as part of a collaboration with the Folklife Center. This month, Ryan Yoder of the Yoder Farm in Danby discusses the need for diversification in agriculture to develop outside markets and improve infrastructure.
Yoder Farm is Ryan, me, Rachel, and our two kids, Torin and Asa, producing a bunch of different diverse calories off of a little piece of land here in Danby. And we're growing things like beans and popcorn and vegetables, strawberries, raspberries, apples, chickens. A lot of the planning initially had to do with all this other stuff in my life where it's like, okay, we need a more sustainable way to live. And so we started putting business plans together for our farm business with the idea that, okay, do as much locally, you know, how much Vermont money can we keep in Vermont? It's that idea that, like, you know, you buy your produce from me, that money recirculates, and you buy it from Price Chopper, 90% of it leaves the state. It's like, duh, why would we not want to keep our money in the state as much as possible? And then the other one was to start trying to be a part of making more sustainable systems. So, for example, more perennial agriculture, sequestering carbon and biomass and in the soil. And we've now actually kind of met a lot of these goals. So it's like, wow, this can happen. I wouldn't have guessed. I have zero business experience. So it was a very big learning curve with all the paperwork and the bookkeeping and all these things that are really pretty horrible and kind of a bummer that you even have to deal with all that stuff. But I'm trying to do this as a business. Unfortunately, it's agriculture. It's like about as marginal of a business as you can have. And then we're doing all this demonstration stuff as well, all this oovy groovy, let's try some new things. And that's great, but it costs money. And it doesn't have an immediate return when you're planting trees. So in the meantime, we're continuing with all the annual production that we do. Given the current context of economics and agriculture, we need outside markets if we're going to thrive so that we can do these awesome other projects. To do that, you know, we need things like the food center where we can aggregate, where we can market and distribute, where we can have food processing facilities. And simultaneously, that creates infrastructure that hopefully down the road is going to be available so that people in Rutland have food to eat.
That's Ryan Yoder of Yoder Farm in Danby. His voice is part of a series created by the Vermont Folklife Center in Middlebury called Growing Food, Growing Farmers. You can hear more at vpr.net. The history of Western music is filled with individuals who've had a profound influence on their peers and on the generations who followed. One such musician was Nadia Boulanger. Boulanger held positions at many colleges and universities in France and the United States, including the Paris Conservatory, Wellesley College, and Juilliard. She was in such high demand that students from around the world would come to her for instruction. VPR Classical host James Stewart shares her story from his series on music history, Timeline.
Aaron Copland, Jean Francex, Elliot Carter, Philip Glass, and Quincy Jones. What do all of these musicians have in common? They were all students of Nadia Boulanger. Nadia was a composer, conductor, and teacher. For 7 decades out of her family's flat in Paris, she taught some of the most influential composers of the 20th century. Nadia's father was a composer and violin professor at the Paris Conservatory. Nadia's memory was so proficient that by the time she was 12, she had Bach's Wild Temper Clavier memorized. She attended the Paris Conservatory along with her younger sister, Lily. The sisters shared instructors and even prizes. In 1908, Nadia received second place in the Prix de Rome for her composition La Sirène. A few years later, Lily became the first woman to win first place in that same competition. Nadia took it upon herself to oversee her sister's education. Lily was a prolific and talented composer. By the time she was 20, she had an impressive catalog of works. However, she suffered from chronic illness, which took her life at the age of 24. After Lily's death, Nadia all but abandoned composition. She focused on conducting. Nadia broke new ground as a conductor, and many of the orchestras she visited, she was the first female to stand on the podium. She helped rediscover the music of Claudio Monteverdi and championed works by contemporary composers, including her good friend Igor Stravinsky. She conducted the premiere of his Dumbarton Oaks Concerto in 1938. It is her influence as a teacher that has left the most indelible mark. Nadia Boulanger held positions at many colleges and universities in France and the United States, including the Paris Conservatory, Wellesley College, and Juilliard. She was in such high demand that students from around the world would come to her for instruction. Nadia encouraged her students to take in as much music as possible. She was said to have every major work by every major composer at her fingertips. Her methods were difficult.
She was very fussy.
The biographer Alan Kendall called her the tender tyrant. Yet her practice of counterpoint and score reading are still used in conservatories around the world. As one student recalled, Nadia would say, "Your music can never be more or less than you are as a human being." Nadia continued to promote the music of her sister throughout her life. She died in 1979 at the age of 92. She's buried next to Lily at Montmartre Cemetery in Paris. Find out more about Nadia and Lily Boulanger and follow the timeline at vpr.net/timeline.
Timeline is an exploration into the development of Western music produced by VPR Classical's James Stewart. Each episode is a small musical history lesson, and you can subscribe to the podcast to hear all the stories at vpr.net. Now it's time for the mailbag.
That's the part of the show when we read some of your questions and comments.
Oh, hey, it's producer Sam Gale Rosen. Hey, Sam.
Hi, Jane. Many of you wrote in to share your reactions following our show last week on bullying. Colin wrote, "I have been one of those bullied during both elementary school and high school. Swirlies, wedgies, clothes trashed, and other such things. That being said, for a student to go and report the situation to an adult is perhaps the worst thing the student can do. The other students will find out who did the tattling, and that kid will get labeled as a narc or rat. The bullying will increase and become much more violent and make the individual being bullied even more isolated, even from those they once called friends."
And Maggie says, "We as adults, political leaders, teachers, parents, etc., have an enormous responsibility to catch our own prejudicial remarks and bullying behaviors. Moreover, I think politicians among us need to take more seriously how words are powerful and how sticking to the issues is best for a civil, thoughtful debate and solution generation."
After our show earlier this week on asylum seekers crossing the border into Canada, one Canadian listener named Kathy described a conversation it spurred with her husband. "Can you imagine leaving our home, leaving everything we know, leaving all our belongings, carrying nothing but a suitcase and the clothes on our back, and imagine carrying a baby and trying to find a place that would accept us in this weather?" Kathy wrote, "We are a wealthy country. We have peace and security and everything we need. We must share or live with the shame and the consequences."
Many of you also had thoughts about our discussion earlier this week on how scientists can defend the value of their work without getting caught up in partisan debates. Marianne says, "People lost faith in science when it became clear that greed fuels research and development of marketable products. Look at the pharmaceutical industry. There's so much greed there, we don't know who to trust. When pharmaceutical products are proven to cause harm, the manufacturer simply pays a fine. There is no moral outrage."
And Greg wrote, "I'm a Vermonter in the PhD program in Meteorology and Physical Oceanography at the University of Miami's Rosenstiel School of Marine and Atmospheric Science. I really appreciated listening to this episode, as this skepticism is something I am continually fighting as a climate scientist."
New Bob, too, has a suggestion. "It would be a good exercise for each of us to recall a recent instance of having to change a belief based on scientific information that was new to us, just to be sure we actually believe in the scientific method and don't just use science as a cover for our ideology."
Finally, Kelly Ladyga, Vice President of Corporate Communications of Vail Resorts Incorporated, emailed us after our interview with Alex Kaufman about the sale of Stowe Mountain Resorts to Vail. Alex had been wondering if Vail might try to trademark the name Stowe as it had done with other resorts it owns. Kelly wrote with this clarification. Both the names Stowe and Stowe Mountain Resort are already trademarked with regard to year-round recreational services, namely providing facilities for skiing, hiking, sightseeing, golfing, tennis, swimming, alpine sliding, and summer concerts, so as to protect the resort from other mountain resorts using the same name for the same activities. It's the same as what we've done with our resorts and what most resorts in the ski industry have done. I would assume that AIG trademarked them.
And AIG was the owner of, and still is, of Stowe Mountain Resort prior to the sale to Vail. Thank you for that clarification, and listeners, thank you for telling us your thoughts. We always welcome your comments and questions.
You can email us at vermontedition@vpr.net or post your thoughts on Twitter, Facebook, or on our website.
Thanks, Sam.
Thank you, Jane.
Tomorrow on this program, we will talk to Vermont Speaker of the House Mitzi Johnson. We're going to talk about a wide range of legislative issues, from the budget gap to marijuana legalization. Send your questions, as always, to vermontedition@vpr.net and join us live tomorrow at noon. Our producers are Rick Singeri, Sam Gail Rosen, and Meg Malone. Jake Rusnak directed the show, and our executive producer is Patty Daniels. I'm Jane Lindholm. Thanks for listening.